Well, we move from the 17th century and the context of the United Kingdom and the wars of that period in the around the English Civil War and British early British Baptists to the 18th century and the period of the American Revolution. And our third plenary session presenter is Dr. Keith Harper, who earned his PhD in American history here in Kentucky at the University of Kentucky. He currently serves as professor of church history at the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary and is also the editor of the online Journal of Baptist Studies. He has written fairly extensively in 19th century Baptist history, a collection of letters and writings of Lottie Moon, and then also a work that he did on the whole area of the debate among Northern and Southern Baptists, antebellum prior to the Civil War regarding slavery. He will address us on the subject of Baptists and the American Revolution.
Before I get started, I would like to thank you, Michael, for the invitation, and I would like for I'd like to thank you for the hospitality that the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary has extended to all of us. Our accommodations have been superior. And the gifts of the books, please register our appreciation to those who are responsible for that, if you would. Well, as Michael told you, my topic today is Baptist during the American Revolution, and I'm going to do something just a wee bit different because if you want to look at military attitudes about Baptists during the Revolutionary era, you could do very well to go back and reread Anthony's paper from earlier today. And you would notice that some were for it, some were against it, and some were ambivalent. That's basically the way that the military attitude tracked about the revolution itself. But in looking at the Baptists as far as what's going on before the revolutionary era itself, and in the years immediately after the revolution, you have something very interesting going on that strikes at the heart of Baptist identity in America. It is what my title suggests, a revolution within the revolution, the Philadelphia Association and the search for a usable polity. The Reverend Samuel Jones was a busy man in the winter of 1797. In addition to his pastoral duties at Lower Dublin Baptist Church, one of the late 18th century's better known Baptist churches, Jones was an active participant in the Philadelphia Baptist Association, or the PBA. In 1795, the association tapped him to produce a new treatise on discipline that would articulate the bounds of proper church order. On December 26, 1797, as Jones put the finishing touches on the new treatise, the association may have felt a collective sense of deja vu. After all, they had played similar scenes before. A cursory survey of PBA history suggests that the association struggled with polity issues throughout the 18th century. By definition, polity covers the organizational principles and behavior of a religious group. Historically, Baptists have argued that local churches are responsible for fulfilling Christian ministry. As such, Baptist churches select and ordain their own ministers, police their own affairs, and conduct their business as voluntary organizations apart from outside authorities such as bishops. As American Baptists became more numerous, defining intra-church and inter-church relations became increasingly difficult. From its inception in 1707, the Philadelphia Association relied on Elias Keach's The Glory and Ornament of a True Gospel-Constituted Church to explicate specific application of a Baptist ecclesiology or the doctrine of the church. But in 1743, the association replaced Keach with Benjamin Griffith's A Short Treatise Concerning a True and Orderly Gospel Church. But by the mid-1790s, the association had grown dissatisfied with Griffith's short treatise, deeming it materially defective. The PBA would not reach its centennial before it had affirmed three different polity statements. And even more intriguing, between 1774 and 1794, the association publicly distanced themselves from Morgan Edwards, the customs of the primitive churches, and heard requests that they print and distribute to others, namely Thomas Craner's A Scripture Manual, or A Plain and Scriptural Representation of a Gospel Church, published in 1759, and John Gill's Nature, Order, and Discipline of a Gospel Church. St. Paul's admonition for all things to be done decently and in order was not lost on the PBA's churches, but nailing down the particulars of church order proved difficult. The 18th century marked a time of dramatic social, cultural, and political change for all Americans, especially Baptists. Having given the better part of 2 years to a careful consideration of Baptist life in late 18th century America, few understood his contemporaries' needs for a fresh perspective on how to do church better than Jones. As he saw it, churches should beware who they accepted as members, maintain strict discipline, walk in Christian love with other believers, and perform their God-given duties in a manner worthy of their Christian calling. Finally, and perhaps most significant, he cautioned churches to maintain and preserve temper, coolness, and impartiality in your meetings of business. To be rigid, obstinate, partial, passionate, and overbearing in administering the concerns of the house of God. How unlike the followers of the meek and lowly Jesus. How unworthy of office under their divine master. Revivalism, persecution, and the lurch toward independence stretched Baptist churches and ministers to their limits. Balancing orthodoxy and orthopraxy in the face of numerical growth and rapid cultural change forced Baptists to consider repeatedly the proper bounds of church fellowship, reshape the expectations that churches had for their pastors, and vice versa. Their treatises on discipline reflect how dramatic and far-ranging such changes really were. Let's begin by taking a look at Elias Keach, the glory and ornament of a true gospel-constituted church. In 1707, the particular brethren, and such as they thought most capable, from five churches in the Philadelphia area formed Philadelphia Association. They agreed to meet annually to consult about such things as were wanting in the churches and to set them in order. From the outset, it was clear the association intended to stand collective watch over their ministers and their churches. They agreed not to allow strangers, that is, someone unknown to them or having no letter of recommendation to preach in their churches or even enjoy privileges of fellowship. They further agreed that aggrieved church members who could not find resolution to their problems in their churches could appeal to the association for a redress. The association's decision would be binding then on all parties. Once organized, the fledgling association chose the Second London Confession as their theological standard. As such, they identified themselves with particular Baptists, well known for their Calvinistic theology. In addition to its emphasis on God's sovereignty over human affairs, the Second London's 26th chapter of the Church articulated a careful, nuanced ecclesiology, or doctrine of the Church. In 15 separate subpoints, the Confession defined the Church and sketched out church life on a host of issues ranging from officers to interchurch relationship. The Confession's first article, of the Holy Scriptures, subpoint 6, stipulated that Baptists recorded everything, or the Bible recorded everything humanity needed to know about God's glory, salvation, and holy living. It further stipulated, nevertheless, we acknowledge the inward illumination of the Spirit of God to be necessary for the saving understanding of such things as are revealed in the Word, and that there are some circumstances concerning the worship of God and government of the Church common to humane action and societies, which are to be ordered by the light of nature and Christian prudence according to the general rules of the Word, which are always to be observed. Theological consensus notwithstanding, churches enjoyed a degree of latitude in religious expression and church government. Benjamin Keach served as one of the principal architects of the Second London Confession. A recognized leader among England's late 17th century particular Baptists, Keach was both perceptive and prolific. In 1697, he and his son, Elias, both issued treatises on church order. According to one scholar, the treatises were published in the name of their respective congregations under different titles, but the contents were identical. The Keaches understood the latitude that existed between the confession's ecclesiological statement and the concession that certain aspects of worship were best left, according to Christian prudence, according to the general rules of the word. They also understood that differing understandings of how to apply Scripture to specific situations left room for disagreement and disorder. Hence, their treatises sought to forestall controversies by offering guidelines that delineated the relationship between ministers and their congregations. After detailing the nature of a church, Keach contrasted the work of the pastor, bishop, and overseer with the duty of church members to their pastors. Certain ministerial duties like preaching and superintending the ordinances were obvious. Likewise, church members could expect their ministers to pray for them and visit them for a variety of reasons ranging from rebuke to exhortation. Further, church members could expect their ministers to comport themselves with dignity and grace as befitting the gospel, thereby setting a good example for the church to follow. Finally, Keach stipulated that ministers should serve their congregations without partiality. Of course, certain congregational duties toward their ministers were likewise apparent. Ministers could expect their members to pray for them and respect their office. Beyond prayer and respect, Keach maintained that church members should submit to their ministers, obey them, and seek their pastor's counsel in times of trouble or temptation. Additionally, they should support their pastor by supplying his physical needs and protecting his reputation by squashing bad reports. That is, they should support their pastor in times of affliction. And Keach noted that church members should willingly come together at the appointed time for worship. That is, ministers could expect church members to show up for church. Seems apparent. And Keach dedicated the remainder of Glory and Ornament to general matters ranging from receiving new members to dealing with heretics. He concluded his treatise with an extended exhortation to righteous living and an 8-point covenant that reiterated the little book's main themes. And since a significant portion of the discipline is in catechism form, Keach may have intended ministers to teach it point by point in question and answer format. As Keach saw it, healthy church life reflected order as manifested in what church members believed and how they conducted themselves. On the one hand, order demanded assent and fidelity to the confession of faith. Particular Baptists shared a number of theological tenets with other groups like Presbyterians, but they also had a number of theological distinctives. Maintaining theological consensus would not be possible apart from the confession. On the other hand, order demanded reciprocity, which in turn demanded that everyone know and accept their place in the church. Ministers tended their flocks as Christ's under-shepherds, while members looked after each other in mutual submission to the pastor's leadership and to one another. Obviously, ministers played the lead role in maintaining harmonious church relations. They were to preach the Scriptures faithfully and serve as exemplars of theological moral rectitude. Early 18th century Baptists near Philadelphia knew Elias Keach long before he published Glory and Ornament. Young Keach sailed to Philadelphia in 1686 as a 19-year-old lad. Upon learning of his celebrity, the Philadelphia Baptists assumed that he had followed his father into ministry and allowed him to preach in their churches. However, in one of the more curious episodes of American Baptist history, Keach was converted under his own preaching about 1688. And you think it's strange today. Well, in 1688, he was later baptized, ordained, and installed as pastor of the Lower Dublin congregation until 1692 when he returned to England. Upon his conversion, Keach became one of the most popular preachers in the Philadelphia area. Pennsylvania offered colonial-era Baptists a modicum of toleration, but they could ill afford internal dissent, especially if it invited unwarranted scrutiny from local authorities. The association usually addressed potentially divisive issues through the collective wisdom of the association's messengers. Between 1707 and 1742, the association heard no fewer than 25 queries from local church members or from local churches. None of the recorded queries posed direct theological questions. Rather, in each case, the church appealed to the association's collective wisdom in answering practical questions or how to apply the theology that they thought they knew. Not surprisingly, the Philadelphia Association had no qualms in using glory and ornament as a guide for settling disputes in the church when it was applicable. In 1712, an unspecified, grievous contention arose in the Morristown Church. The association sent ministerial mediators who suggested to bring things to right order, they, the church, should subscribe to Elias Keach's Confession of Faith, at least to the covenant annexed to it. In 1728, the association considered a query from the church at Montgomery, namely, whether a church is bound to grant a letter of dismissal to any members to go to another church while his residence is not removed. They answered in the negative and cited the discipline for precedent. Keach's discipline, of course. In 1735, the association declined to approve of quote-unquote well-wishers becoming members of churches far distant from places of his abode if a church of the same order was nearby. And once again, they cited the Confession of Faith, chapter 27, and the Treatise on Discipline, pages 28 and 29. The Confession of Faith may have provided a thorough statement of what Baptist Church looked like in the abstract, but certain aspects of their ecclesiology remained open for discussion. Churches were not obligated to worship alike. Neither did they all face the same challenges. In its early years, the Philadelphia Association tended to be limited in its scope. But given its emphasis on church life at the congregational level, glory and ornament proved a worthy guide for ordering church life on several occasions. As Baptists became more numerous and the association grew, the terms for interchurch fellowship began to change. And before long, glory and ornament became dated, and the PBA found itself searching for an updated discipline. And that brings us to Benjamin Griffith, A Short Treatise. In 1742, the Philadelphia Association made an important decision. Assuming they could secure funding, the PBA agreed to reprint the Confession of Faith set forth by the elders of the baptized congregations met in London, A.D. 1689, with a short treatise of church discipline to be annexed to the Confession of Faith. Overall, they were satisfied with Second London, but they agreed an addition of two articles be therein inserted, that is to say, concerning of singing of psalms in the worship of God and laying on of hands upon baptized believers. The association chose Jenkin Jones and Benjamin Griffith to produce the new discipline with no explanation for why they needed it. Nonetheless, in 1743, the association approved their new discipline, apparently with little discussion. In many respects, Benjamin Griffith was a natural choice to pen the new discipline. Born in Wales in 1688, Griffith sailed for America in 1710 and received baptism in 1711. In 1725, he was ordained and became pastor of the Montgomery Church, a pulpit he filled until his death in 1768. In addition to his ministerial skills, Griffith wrote several tracts defending Baptist faith and practice. His finished essay, A Short Treatise Concerning a True and Orderly Gospel Church, immediately became the association's official polity statement. There can be no doubt that Griffith followed Keach's glory and ornament with a couple of noteworthy exceptions. First, Griffith echoed Keach's description of ministers as preachers and godly examples. Whereas Keach offered no advice for securing ministers, Griffith admonished churches without pastors to look first within their own fellowship. If they could find no suitable pastor in their own ranks, they could seek help from other congregations. If they had a potential minister who was not ready for the task, Griffith urged, let such as they have, if they have any that seem hopeful, to be a while upon trial, and the Lord shall choose, will furnish or flourish for some good measure with Aaron's rod among the rods of the tribes. In any event, Griffith encouraged churches not to set unrealistic expectations for potential pastors in either their preaching skills or their conduct. Now, stop me if this sounds familiar along the way. How do you get your pastor? Well, You got to be careful about who you get, and you can't be unrealistic in that search. In addition to its advice on where to secure ministers, Griffith's treatise, short treatise, also contained an article on ruling elders. Keach had dismissed ruling elders as an apostolic office, but Griffith included them among officers needed for orderly churches. By definition, ruling elders are such persons as are endued with gifts to assist the pastor or teacher in the government of the church. Griffith recognized both teaching and ruling as pastoral duties, but in case he is unable or the work of the ruling elder is too great for him, God has provided such for his assistance, and they are called ruling elders. Griffith further stipulated that ruling elders served in administrative capacities only, unless they were gifted to be teachers. And in the event that a ruling elder was found capable of teaching, Griffith recommended ordination, with the understanding that such ordination was unto a distinct office from the former, which was only to rule well and not to labor in the word and the doctrine. Griffith concluded his short treatise with a detailed section titled Of the Communion of the Churches. In it, he detailed the terms of intra-church fellowship. Granted, churches had formed associations long before Keach produced Glory and Ornament in 1697. However, Keach had said nothing about church life at the associational level. Conversely, Griffith carefully detailed the limits of church fellowship at the associational level, noting that all churches were equal in power and dignity, and we read of no disparity between them or subordination among them. Griffith also noted that churches may exercise close fellowship, but the officers of one particular church may not act as officers in another church in any act of government without a particular call thereunto from the other church where that occasionally comes from. As for the associations, Short Treatise suggests that churches had a collective responsibility toward one another in maintaining gospel order. Griffith stipulated that while churches were independent and autonomous, a general fellowship benefited all concerned. Associations facilitated such fellowship and offered counsel when churches needed advice. However, Griffith stipulated, yet such delegates thus assembled are not entrusted or armed with any coercive power or any superior jurisdiction over the churches concerned so as to impose their determinations upon them or their officers under the penalty of excommunication or the like. Notwithstanding the PBA's endorsement, Griffith's take on associationalism did not supply the final word on associational authority. In 1744, one Simon Butler petitioned the PBA for help in settling an unspecified dispute in the Montgomery Church. The minutes for the following year indicate that the association's four-man deputation had indeed settled the earlier dispute, but not to Butler's satisfaction. Later, in 1746, the association answered five queries on a variety of issues ranging from who could preach lawfully to who could partake of communion. And once again, the association's answers irked certain constituent churches. In 1747, or the 1747 circular letter noted, I should say, as to the sneers and reflections cast by some on our answers to questions sent us last year, we leave the authors to delight themselves in the product of their admiring fancies, seeing no cause to alter our apprehension, being persuaded that it is the duty of the churches to call and prove their candidates for the ministry, whom we judge ought to wait with self-denying meekness, humbleness, and lowliness of mind to a further approbation from the churches of their ordination and investiture into the sacred functions, and not urge or hasten it themselves contrary to the mind and judgment of the church which gave them a call to exercise their gift. In other words, be careful who you put in the ministry. By 1748, it was obvious that the association needed to define the limits of its own authority. So in 1749, Griffith produced an essay that clarified his earlier writing. He noted that associations did not have extensive power, but they did bear a collective responsibility for maintaining theological integrity and church stability. To that end, churches formed associations based on mutual cooperation for the good of all. He clarified his earlier assertion that associations had no coercive power by stipulating that churches could not exclude other churches from the association, but they could disown and withdraw from a defective and disorderly church and advise the churches related to them to withdraw from and to discountenance such aforesaid without exceeding the bounds of their power. One might easily read too much into them, but Griffith's short treatise and his essay on the limits of associational authority raise a number of important issues. First, the PBA's churches appear to have been struggling with securing competent ministers. Of course, churches without pastors wanted capable ministers who would model Christianity for the flock. The association maintained that gospel order required that churches have ministers. Moreover, empty pulpits exposed churches to sham preachers. As Griffith wrote short treatise, the association may have still been smarting from the Piscataway Church's tawdry dealings with one Henry Lovell. About 1729, the church ordained Lovell to the ministry, despite the association's suggestion not to rush to ordination. Unfortunately, within a year, the church learned that Lovell was actually Desolate Baker, a syphilitic bigamist. To make matters worse, the church had bypassed associational ministers and ordained Lovell with the assistance of Paul Palmer, a visiting theologically Arminian Baptist minister from South Carolina. Ultimately, the Piscataway Church found a more suitable minister, but their experience with Henry Lovell served as a pointed reminder that the association's advice, while not binding, represented collective wisdom and experience, and one ignored such advice to their peril. Beyond the difficulty in finding suitable preachers, Griffith's inclusion of ruling elders as a valid office for his contemporaries suggested that administration of local churches was becoming increasingly difficult. The sources do not specify if ministers had too many people to visit or if church members lived too far apart. Nevertheless, by 1743, ruling elders had become an accepted way of ensuring pastoral assistance beyond the diaconate for local Baptist churches, at least in the association. Griffith's phrasing may also shed light on mid-18th century church life. Keach spoke of the pastor's work and the church member's duty. Griffith likewise spoke of a church member's duty, but his admonition for churches not to be too picky in selecting ministers hints at changing perceptions of ministers and rising expectations from congregations. Historian E. Brooks Holyfield has observed that the 18th century witnessed a transition in popular perception of ministerial roles, thanks in part to the Great Awakening, changing concepts of sin, and the degree to which ministers comforted the afflicted. As the revivals spread in America, Baptist numbers increased markedly, and they gained a measure of grudging respect. New converts led to new churches, and as the number of churches increased, so did the number of Baptist associations. As their numbers increased throughout the colonies, Baptists faced new challenges in maintaining local church independence while delineating the limits of the association's authority. And that brings us to a period of time between Griffith and Jones. Griffith's supplemental essay on associational authority clarified what associations could and could not do, but it did not answer all questions bearing on Baptist polity. There is considerable evidence that PBA churches continued to seek clarity on procedural issues in their churches. For instance, between 1707 and 1807, the association heard at least 105 queries from its churches, 15 between 1744 and 1749, 65 between 1750 and 1807. Obviously, Griffith's short treatise left many practical questions unresolved. With so many open questions, Baptists in America consulted a variety of sources to answer their polity questions. In 1768, Morgan Edwards, pastor of the Philadelphia Church and one of the association's best-known ministers, published The Customs of the Primitive Churches. Edwards outlined 54 propositions that he believed represented proper church order. He also offered extensive notation for each proposition, in many cases detailing precisely how the proposition should be enacted. In 1774, the association apparently heard several unspecified queries from the Welch Tract Church regarding customs and its potential usefulness as the association's discipline. In response, the association stipulated, whereas a book was published entitled The Customs of the Primitive Churches, which the author proposed should be altered, amended, or corrected by his ministerial brethren and then reprinted for the use of the churches, which was never done, and whereas we have reason to think that it is understood by many abroad to have been adopted by us in its present form as our custom and mode of church discipline and practice, it is therefore thought meet that we should publicly testify to the contrary, as it is not, nor ever has been adopted by us or by any of the churches belonging to the association. While the association did not deny the work's possible benefit, they wanted all concerned to know that they had neither commissioned it nor officially affirmed it. Polity issues took a back seat to more pressing domestic concerns as the American Revolution began forging 13 colonies into one nation. Generally, the association's churches were eager to jettison the standing order and gain religious freedom. Most of the association's churches supported the revolution. The PBA's minutes from 1776 to 1783 are peppered with references to British oppression and ravages and desolations. Annual meetings were poorly attended, but the messengers who could assemble urged their brethren to pray, to fast, and to remain faithful. Preoccupied with the revolution, the PBA laid aside most of their polity issues for another day. However, Elhanan Winchester forced the association to consider two interconnected issues, namely the precise nature of heresy and who controlled the church. The full story is complicated, but briefly stated, the Philadelphia church called Winchester as their pastor in 1780. As flamboyant as he was sincere, Winchester's commanding pulpit presence won many friends and sparked a season of growth in the church. The prospects for both pastor and church appeared bright until 1781, when the PBA's minutes indicate that Winchester had espoused universalism and plunged the church into turmoil. Theologically, Winchester denied eternal punishment for the wicked, a basic tenet of the Philadelphia Confession of Faith, and a clear majority of the Philadelphia church backed Winchester regardless of what he preached. He refused to resign as pastor, even after the Orthodox minority reminded him that to their way of thinking, he had declared himself to be a heretic by denying the confession of faith. For the next 3 years, the church engaged in a raucous public battle over who really constituted the Philadelphia church and who should retain control of the church facilities. Concerned with the church's welfare, the association tried to mediate the controversy. According to their discipline and well-established precedent, the PBA sent respected ministers to offer advice and help broker an amicable settlement. However, each side had drawn their own battle lines, and neither side really wanted compromise. Moreover, the association had no real power beyond identifying the salient issues and advising accordingly. Ultimately, the association's mediators sided with the minority and advised all concerned to beware of Elhanan Winchester and not admit him or any who advocated universal salvation to the office of public teaching or suffer any who avowed the same to continue in their communion. Winchester's dealings with the Philadelphia Church left the association especially sensitive to theological irregularities and ministerial misconduct. In 1781, the minutes warned the association's churches to steer clear of Robert Morris, the former pastor of the Stamford Church, who had been excommunicated for gross immoralities and departure from the faith as held by us. The same minutes indicate that the association took an even sterner stand against David Branson. In 1773, the association observed that the New Mills Church had excommunicated their pastor, David Branson, for unspecified reasons, and warned churches to beware of him. Branson resurfaced in 1781 at the height of the Winchester controversy, once again masquerading as a Baptist minister. This time, the association took drastic action as they instructed a certain Brother Blackwell to draw up an advertisement informing the public that David Branson, who imposes on them under the character of a Baptist preacher, is an excommunicated person and ought not by any means to be countenanced. After discussion and minor editing, the association proved the advertisement and ordered it to be inserted into a Philadelphia newspaper. Despite their broadsides and admonitions, the association could do little to stifle universalism in its ranks. In 1787, the minutes note that Duncan MacLean had espoused universalism, followed by William Worth of Pittsgrove in 1789. The association denounced Worth in no uncertain terms, stating, "We, therefore, to show our abhorrence of his doctrine, universal salvation, and of his disingenuous conduct for a long time past, caution our churches to beware of him, and of artist Seagraves, of the same place also, who has espoused their doctrine." Even Samuel Jones's special circular letter for the association in 1790, in which he described universalism both as a leprosy and a dangerous plague, could not halt universalism's advance, at least not completely. The association minutes for 1793 reported that Joseph Stevens, late pastor of Upper Freehold, had been excommunicated for holding the erroneous doctrine of universal salvation. Ministerial failures and defections to universalism did nothing to bolster the association's already strained polity consensus. The association began hearing calls for something to supplement or to replace Griffith's short treatise as early as 1783, when the Welch Tract Church requested the association reprint and distribute Thomas Craner's A Scripture Manual. The association observed, "We have agreed to publish the introductory sermon on the same subject, and our ports are now open. The churches disposed may furnish themselves from abroad. In the event the work had gone, In the event the work had gone out of print, the association appointed Samuel Jones, William Van Horn, and Thomas Eustick to examine said piece and consider the propriety of its republication." The minutes make no further mention of Craner or a scripture manual, but the implications seem clear enough. The Welch Tract Church was not satisfied with Griffith, and they were probably not alone. Polity issues persisted into the 1790s. Churches queried the association on matters ranging from who could participate in the Lord's Supper and restoration of fellowship between quarreling brethren to proper subjects and administrators of baptism. In 1792, the church at Marcus Hook asked, "Would it not be expedient for this association to republish Dr. Gill's Nature, Order, and Discipline of a Gospel Church or some other equally good and recommend it to the same churches?" The association responded that most of the association's churches were unlikely familiar with this essay in question and suggested that concerned parties make themselves acquainted therewith against the next meeting or next annual association, by which means they will be prepared to determine upon the expediency thereof. In other words, get one, read one, we'll talk about it whenever we come together again. But when the association met in 1793, they did not discuss reprinting Gill. But in 1795, they appointed Samuel Jones to revise their existing discipline. Initially charged with presenting his revisions to the 1796 association meeting, Jones missed his deadline and offered his revisions to the 1797 meeting. Given its past difficulties, the association wanted as much agreement as possible on this new discipline, and they took measures to secure a workable consensus. Each church in the association agreed to send a representative to a meeting on the second Tuesday in December next at 2 o'clock p.m. in the city of Philadelphia to take into consideration and make such alterations as unto them may appear proper. With everyone's input in hand, Jones put the finishing touches on his treatise on church order. Significantly, his preparatory comments state the association had judged their previous discipline, that is, Griffin's short treatise, to be materially defective, but he did not list specific weaknesses. In fact, Jones followed Griffith's work where he could, much as Griffith had followed Keach. Yet Jones differed from Griffith in at least four areas. Jones's first chapter of A Gospel Church provided a detailed definition of what constituted a church, beginning with using the Greek word ekklesia as a basis for his definition. Much of what followed echoed Griffith and Keach with respect to mutual love and support. However, Jones introduced new material under the headings of settling a minister over a church and of dissolving the connection between a church and his pastor. Of course, churches were free to choose their own ministers, but Jones liked the relationship, or linked rather, the relationship between a minister and his church to a marriage. If the association wanted its affiliate churches to maintain gospel order, they needed long-term ministers shepherding their flocks, a point Jones made with great care. Unfortunately, not all ministers stayed in their churches for the long haul. Some left for better prospects, others for moral failure or issues that could not be resolved through regular channels. By the mid-1790s, the issue warranted its own treatment in a new discipline. Jones reiterated that ideally, churches and pastors maintained a binding relationship. However, should a minister's situation become untenable, it really did not matter who shouldered the blame. It was best for ministers to leave their church once their position as ministers had been compromised. In separating, Jones noted that a council of surrounding churches should be called to ensure an amicable separation. If the church could not dismiss their pastor with a positive recommendation, Jones maintained the council should list the differences between the pastor and the church and give their judgment for the sake of the minister's next pastorate. Finally, Jones concluded his discipline with a thoughtful statement on associational life. Among other things, he maintained that delegates or messengers from cooperating churches met in association to gain acquaintance with and knowledge of one another, to preserve informally in faith and practice, Philippians 3:16, to detect and discountenance heresies, to curb licentiousness in the wanton abuse of church power, to afford assistance and advice in all difficult cases, to contribute pecuniary aid when necessary, to make appointments of supplies for destitute churches, and every way advance and secure the interest of religion and strengthen and draw closer the bonds of union and fellowship. And to this he quickly added, the delegates thus assembled are, properly speaking, only an advisory council. They are not armed with coercive power to compel churches to submit to their decisions, nor have they any control over their acts or the acts or the doings of their churches. Of course, the association maintained the right to withdraw fellowship from churches they deemed irregular. Now, what happens to Baptist life beyond this treatise? By 1807, the Philadelphia Association had witnessed a number of spectacular changes. The colonies of British North America had become the United States of America. The Bill of Rights guaranteed religious liberty. Settlers were flooding into Western lands, some of which had already been warmed by frontier revivals. Through it all, the PBA acquitted itself rather well. What began as a small fellowship of five marginal Baptist churches had grown to an impressive network of churches and associations throughout the various states. The PBA's minutes for 1790 include a Baptist census that boasted 30 like-minded associations, with 454 ministers, 533 churches, and a total membership of almost 51,000. Not bad for 1807, or rather 1790. Notwithstanding bright national prospects, expansion on all fronts, and three separate disciplines, the PBA never completely resolved its polity issues. In 1807, the beleaguered Philadelphia Church queried the association about forming a committee to study the new discipline. They offered no specifics, but the church believed the new discipline contradicted the old discipline and the two should be harmonized. Perhaps weary of rehashing the same irksome issues, the association declined to appoint a study committee, deeming their request not expedient. The association was ready to move forward with Jones's treaty at the ready should polity issues arise. Baptists were well positioned to reap the windfall of religious liberty. They maintained a unique ecclesiology that allowed for a flexible church polity. They believed churches were independent and autonomous, and as such, churches of like faith and order could form associations for the well-being of member churches. These unions maintained a theological consensus based on a common confession of faith. Group consensus determined specific application and interpretation of the confession. Churches participated in associations voluntarily. Such flexibility proved beneficial as Baptists pushed westward in the late 18th and early 19th century. Yet, the national impulses that had spurred Baptist growth had placed considerable strain on the Philadelphia Association. Throughout its first 100 years, the PBA faced persistent challenges to interpret and apply correct doctrine, as well as specify the limits of proper associational authority. Between 1707 and 1807, the Philadelphia Association never changed its theological understanding of ecclesiology, but they modified certain of its applications. By comparing Keach, Griffith, and Jones, one sees a remarkable change in expectations. Whereas early 18th century church relations were shaped by corporate reciprocity, early 19th church relationships were increasingly shaped by nascent professionalism. As Keach saw it, church life in the late 17th and early 18th centuries relied on a relatively fixed, stable social order. Ministers and churches lived in a close, reciprocal relationship where ministers tended the flock, which in turn followed Christ under the minister's leadership. Members were accountable to one another for living holy lives. By the early 19th century, Baptist church members were still responsible for holy living, and ministers still functioned as under-shepherds, but the relationship between ministers and congregations had changed. Neither Keach nor Griffith addressed the amicable separation of churches and pastors, much less forced termination. Ideally, pastors would serve their congregations for a lifetime, much like a marriage. However, Jones's discipline suggests that by 1800, a flexible relationship had developed between pastors and churches that belied the lifetime marriage metaphor. Stated simply, churches could oust their pastors, and pastors could voluntarily leave their congregations as long as both left in peace. Rapid growth and national expansion created opportunities. Capable ministers had options to assume prominent pulpits or relocate to areas where growth seemed certain. Consider, for example, John Gano. Reared in a Presbyterian home, Gano became a Baptist and received ordination in 1754 and quickly established himself as one of the association's more capable ministers. In addition to several successful evangelistic forays into the southern colonies, Gano served as the first pastor of First Baptist Church, New York, from 1762 to 1787. He likewise distinguished himself as a chaplain during the American Revolution. Unfortunately, Gano emerged from the Revolution with considerable debt. Consequently, he moved to Kentucky in 1787 at the behest of a certain William Wood. According to Gano, Wood enticed him to the frontier with the prospect of a useful ministry in the Commonwealth's new churches. Equally tantalizing, Wood hinted that Gano might prove, or his move might prove more lucrative. "For these reasons," Gano recalled, "I concluded to move. Besides, I was considerably in debt and saw no way of being released, but by selling my house and my lot. This, I concluded, would clear me and enable me to purchase wagons and horses to carry me to Kentucky." His decision horrified the New York church. Notwithstanding their pleading and their offer to raise his salary if he would stay, Gano was resolved to leave. "I told them," he said, "if they had desired me to stay before I had put it out of my own power, I should have given it up." Gano's stature as an established, credible minister led to his opportunity for usefulness in Kentucky. There's evidence suggesting that capable ministers could position themselves to reap the benefits of America's emerging religious market. For example, the PBA became increasingly interested in ministerial education throughout the 18th century. Some of the association's earliest ministers received their training in British institutions, but there were few options for Americans who could not relocate abroad. Some received training informally at the hands of local church preachers. Others went to American institutions like Hopewell Academy. But things changed in 1764 with the charter of Rhode Island College. Under James Manning's leadership, the college quickly became the flagship Baptist college in America, and the Philadelphia Association funneled its most promising students there to receive their ministerial and their theological training. As ministers wrestled with their changing roles, they agreed that churches needed to remain pure. Yet balancing between local church gatekeeping and building mutual love and respect between church members frequently proved difficult. Each of the disciplines discusses purity, but perhaps none more forcefully than Samuel Jones. In the preface to the 1797 discipline, Jones wasted no time in observing that churches must be careful to guard their membership. Moreover, of church purity, he noted, "Let there be most unremitting attention to maintain strict discipline. The glory of the church, the credit to religion, and the prosperity of Zion depend to a high degree on the circumspect walk of its professors and vigilant zeal of all, especially the officers, for the support of order and gospel discipline." Still, even the strictest discipline could not forestall every theological crisis. Elhanan and Winchester's defection to Universalism demonstrated the association's vulnerability to well-spoken preachers who advocated positions contrary to accepted dogma. The PBA could warn affiliated churches about suspect preachers, but it could do little to stem the tide of presumed heresy beyond withdrawing fellowship from wayward churches. With the rapidly increasing number of churches, ministers were expected to maintain a higher degree of theological watchfulness than ever before. With theological disturbances aside, early 19th century Baptists had every reason to smile to themselves. Why not? Their numbers were increasing. They had garnered a measure of social acceptance for their outspoken defense of religious liberty, and soon they would adopt Luther Rice along with Adoniram and Ann Judson as Baptist missionaries to India. The zeal to convert the world, coupled with America's newfound religious freedom, led to unprecedented organizational growth. Many of the Baptists associated with the PBA embraced the General Missionary Convention of the Baptist denomination in the United States for the propagation of the gospel among the heathen, more commonly known as the Triennial Convention. Arguably, Baptist participation in organized mission work would not have assumed the shape it did without the Philadelphia Association and its network of like-minded churches. In the midst of their newfound status, one can only wonder what might have happened had they reached unanimity on their polity.
Did you want to take questions?
Yep, we've got time. Any questions on Dr. Harper's paper?
Keith, you're talking about unity on polity. Are you talking about the search of the local church for unity in its own polity with help of the association, or are you talking about a unity of their theory about how an association itself relates to the local church?
Actually, that's a great question, Tom, and actually is where those two meet somewhere in the middle. In other words, what can a church do? What can and still be orthodox? What should it do and remain orthodox? That has implications bearing on the local church itself, but whenever you enter into an agreement with other churches that you're going to fellowship together around a certain or a common set of beliefs and practices, you kind of have to ask that question not only of the local church but of the association. So really what we're talking about is a polity that somewhere meets in between.
And that was, so how do you turn, in other words, one of the main things is a confederation of churches that is voluntary. And
yes.
Association is autonomous and has the right to disfellowship churches. so they have the same faith and order. How is it that you determine the right faith and order and the relationship between the local church's determination of it and the association? Who can be this fellowship?
That's a good question. And it's a difficult question because if you disfellowship churches without, you know, without what appears to be just cause, then you've overstepped your bounds. And if you don't do anything, then you haven't maintained doctrinal purity. I think Elhanan Winchester is a great case in point because here is a man who had led the majority of the Philadelphia church to accept universalism. But ultimately, the association sided with the minority. And the issue there was who still held to the Philadelphia Confession of Faith and who really maintained orthodoxy as the rest of the majority, as the majority of the association churches had perceived it. And so what you do is, first of all, you articulate the issue, whatever that issue may be. In this case, there's a couple of issues. Number one, you've got universalism. And number two, you have a church that is practicing this, or at least they're allowing it to go unchecked. What do you do about the doctrine itself? What do you do about your relationship to the church, all right, or the other churches and their relation to that particular church? And in this case, what they said was, according to the Confession of Faith, they had a touchstone, right? You're not practicing orthodoxy. We side with the minority, and that way the association embraces the minority of the church, and the rest of the church, you know, that they just bypass them and leave them to their own devices. So that's a long answer to your question, but what happens is it's based on consensus among the participants who are at the associational meeting. It's the collective wisdom or the collective knowledge, if you will, of the ministers whenever they come together and they consider this, and they took those on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
The story seems to be an example of the principle Ecclesia Semper Reformanda. Mm-hmm. The church is always in need of reformation. But on the one hand, there has to be a certain basic ecclesiological axiom. On the other hand, there needs to be the flexibility because of changing times and unexpected developments in history and expansion. I mean, is this really the picture, this sort of tension between established, principally irreducible minimum, on the other hand, an awareness of the need for flexibility and a willingness to change in the light of the changing world?
I believe there's an awful lot to that, because you have to ask yourself, if you are in a situation where your society is changing, where culture is changing, are you in a position where you can change with that? And the association is struggling with that. And because I believe, at least in part, in their own confession of faith, Article 1 on the scriptures, I believe I mentioned it was subpoint 6, where there's latitude, a certain amount of latitude in how you interpret the scripture. I believe that's one reason why the queries that come to the association consistently reflect not so much is this heresy or is it not heresy, but if we do this, all right, is that okay? You know, there's this tension between what we believe and whether we're applying that in a way that is acceptable. I think that's where the real tension comes in. But I also think that's the real genius of where the association stood watch over the theology of the churches, because there's a series of checks and balances, and when you don't have a hierarchy, when you don't have a bishop, or when you don't have somebody that ultimately says this is the buck stops here. The buck stopped with the collective understanding of what was right and wrong, or what was correct application or not correct application in the fellowship of the ministers. And consequently, when the modern mission movement comes along and you have people that are going, well, now, wait a minute, if we create this organization or this structure, how does that fit into the rest of the picture? And things were very different after 1814, obviously. My point here, among others, you know, is that in this fellowship of ministers that we have here, looking at them in the pre-revolutionary era and beyond, there's something else that's going on here too, because they are in a position to reap the benefits of that expansion, of that organization, and what have you, and they did. But they were already on that track whenever the mission movement really brought about the organizational revolution that it did. Dave.
Yes, sir. say most Baptists were in favor of the break with Britain?
Yes, I would.
And how did they deal with dissent?
Politically, yes, politically I would. But now there is a remarkable correspondence that goes back and forth between Baptists that are here in North America. They still read what each other are writing. They are still very cognizant of what is going on. But after the American Revolution, you really do begin to see Baptists in America and Baptists in Great Britain track somewhat differently. There's a crack that forms there, and I think it widens to a certain extent over time. But yeah, they read after one another, and they know what's going on very much. One of the key things about Baptists in the pre-revolutionary era anyway, is, and it's true of nearly all, it's true of nearly every person who lived in North America in the colonial era, these guys saw themselves as Englishmen. And the coming of the Revolution, we're going to fight because our rights as Englishmen have been violated. So, and even beyond that, the tie in Christ, yes, going back and forth, Andrew Fuller, for example, widely read in North America, and his cohort, those pro-missionary type Baptists, they were very much in tune with what was going on. So, yeah. Politically, yes. Religiously, there's still some affinity, but you see a widening. Tony?
You see a difference between the North and the South on that view.
Early on, somewhat. Revolutionary era, no, you're just as liable to find support for the revolution among Baptists in the South as you are the North. But once those issues are settled, and you see denominationalism, I'll use that with a little d, begin to take shape, and you begin to see the cultural implications of what that looks like. A lot of the cultural, I don't want to step too far out of bounds for the topic of this evening, but when those distinctions become clearer, a good bit of the political turmoil and the cultural turmoil of the day get reflected back through and hashed out in a religious context, and that's where you begin to see greater regionalism. There's always a bit of difference going on. I mean, it helps explain why you have the proliferation of associations where you do. For example, if you read the minutes of the Warren Association, okay, Warren organizes, even though you're close enough in Rhode Island to bop down to Philadelphia if you want to, they form their own association. And in addition to everything else in a religious context that an association does, Warren says right up front, we want everyone to know, we're going to make a political statement with this. We are being persecuted, our rights are being trampled, and as an association of like-minded churches, we are going to do something about that as nearly as we can. So there's a cultural flavor that goes into the formation of an association. There is cultural expediency that goes into the formation of an association. There's geographic considerations to take place. But those begin to get articulated in a more regional context, certainly as you go further into the 19th century. But early on, the amazing thing is, yes, they're different, but the amazing thing is that they have a great deal of agreement among the various associations. That census list that I gave you of the various churches and so forth, maybe at no other time in American history has there been that kind of consensus among that many churches. I mean, I don't know, but to me that's rather remarkable because these people weren't identical, but they were very, very similar. And that's amazing, especially coming out of an era of revolution.
Okay.
Yes?
Keith, first off, thank you very much. Excellent paper. I'll begin my question with a shameless plug, because I'm very excited. Tomorrow I'm doing my stuff on the Baptist Church of the War of 1812.
Okay.
There's going to be some neat sort of tracking on that shameless plug aside. Here we go.
I'm all about shameless plugs.
It's all shameless plugs. What I noticed as I'm reading sort of through the Baptist associations, North and South, is there's a big pairing of God with the revolution. Yeah. The revolution where it becomes this place where the theology of why America is so important in God's plan was proven on the battlefield.
Right.
This is how we beat Britain, is because God was with us. Did you find much of that sort of stuff as it's taking place, as this is going on, that this is sort of, this battlefield, this revolution is a theological proving ground for these new ideas that are coming through, that our rights are being trampled and God is on our side?
As far as millennial expectations are concerned, I found very little as far as Philadelphia was concerned about that. However, that's where the historiography recently, I say recently, within the last generation is really focused, beginning with Nathan Hatch's work on the Sacred Cause of Liberty.
Right.
Also, Ruth Locke, A Visionary Republic, and so forth, if you're familiar with that work. Block picks up on it. But there's a notion of an ongoing holy war, in other words.
Yeah.
And you have your Catholics and your Protestants in the French and the Indian War, where, you know, the Pope, of course, is the Antichrist. Martin Luther taught us that. We all know that. But, you know, it's not that far. I mean, because the Pope's a tyrant, okay, whatever. It's not that far to juxtapose that whole notion of tyranny and the Antichrist onto King George. And that's where a lot of your emphasis shifts. Now, in terms of the association, Philadelphia does not really articulate anything quite like that, at least not in their minutes. And probably because, you know, the more you put your name on something, the easier it is to track you down on that. I'm not saying that they didn't, that they really didn't believe that. I think in terms of millennial expectations, that is probably, and I'm talking off the cuff here, but I'm thinking that's probably one of those things that they, as a unit, said, okay, maybe, maybe, but let's do this. Possibly, let's focus here, you know, and I really think, you know, preacher that I am, I suppose, I really think the one thing they really tried to focus on was the purity of the gospel, the purity of their pulpit, and the purity of their church fellowship, regardless of all these other things that are going around, going on around them, and that was quite a task, absolutely quite a task, but a fun one to read about, I tell you.
Maybe one more question before we break for lunch.
Let me offer one more thing just by way of general observation, and it had no bearing on this paper, but if you're interested in a topic that you want to read up on or dig into, the imposition of hands, that whole intermediary period as far as the Morgan Edwards treatise on church discipline and what have you, the association, I'm convinced of it, would not affirm that discipline because of the way that Morgan Edwards handled the imposition of hands. They had a threefold laying on of hands, and they practiced, there were some churches that practiced it as a church ordinance. You laid hands on new converts after their baptism, you laid hands on ministers at their ordination, and you laid hands on newborn children as the parents named them. And the churches that practiced that the most seem to be the Welsh churches. And I'm thinking that there was probably, I think the early wave of migration had a lot of Welsh preachers in it, and I think there's a shift probably in the consensus of ethnicity that make up the core of that association, because by the early 1790s with the new discipline, you have the Welsh tract church leaving, forming its own association and what have you. That's a fascinating topic if you want to get into migration patterns and such. Fascinating.
Well, thank you very much.